It's 3:07 and you're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Central Time, we'll feature selections from the Wisconsin Film Festival. We'll hear from one University of Wisconsin alum about his new film, Memphis.
First, for most of us, lunch is kind of a sidebar meal, something we cram into a lunchbox or grab on the go between meetings.
But award-winning chef Gail Gann says with a little effort, lunch can be made into something that's both delicious and nutrition. In this week's edition of Food Friday, we asked her why she believes we should give lunch more respect.
You know, I think lunch really is sort of the, you know, the lost stepchild of all the meal periods. But what I love about lunch is it's really an important meal for how the rest of your day goes. Not only that, but if you're having people over for lunch, it's a lot less daunting. I call dinner parties the daunting dinner party because they, you know, they go on for 4 hours and it's expensive and people don't leave and they drink too much. But if you have people over in the midday for lunch, you know, it's like an hour, hour and a half. It's a lot more casual, sort of less stress. You know, less service is expected from you. Again, people aren't drinking as much. And it really, I think, can impact the rest of your day. And it's not just having people over for lunch, but it's also like packing better lunches for yourself, packing better lunches for your kids, maybe going on a picnic as a way to get together with friends, you know, as opposed to going out to dinner to a restaurant. So there's a lot of flexibility in that period, that meal period that I think we're missing up until now.
Well, let's key in on that packed lunch. My work lunch is an afterthought. It's usually leftovers or a sandwich, or I run out and get something at the grocery store or sub shop. Why should we put more thought into that working lunch?
Thus my point, the neglected stepchild. See, you're selling
well,
that
I'm
idea
living it,
right
yeah.
there. Well, part of it is, I mean, you know, your work day is when you want to be the most sharp, the most productive, and to kind of just, you know, not fuel your body for the kind of challenging work you're about to do doesn't make sense to me. And the way, actually, that I wrote the book, along with each recipe, is there's three different categories. There's how to pack it to go and what to pack it with to go. There's what to do to eat it at home with, and there's what to do to make it a party. So they're all recipes that you could pack to go with something else to make a lunch or eat at home with a little more, you know, you got a little more work than you can put into it. Or if you want to make it a big party and a gathering, what other recipe to put with it to make it into a party.
Now, on your crusade to promote lunch and nutrition, you actually went to the White House and you got to speak with First Lady Michelle Obama about nutrition and children's lunches. What did you have to say, and what is her thinking about why lunches matter for kids?
Well, that was sort of the catalyst for the book initially. I was part of the Chefs That God Called into Action for the Chefs Move to School initiative, and it was as my son was starting high school. So 3.5 years ago, I got to go to the White House. I got to hear Michelle Obama speak inspirationally about the importance of lunch, the importance of improving lunches for our school children, and she asked for my help. And I gave it to her as much as I possibly could. I also, you know, have restaurants and kids of my own and write cookbooks and do television. But what I did was I signed on to mentor my son's high school and the lunch program there. Which meant two things. I could actually help improve the lunch program at his school, but I could spy on him at the same time, but he couldn't actually nail me for it. But there was this idea to me, you know, kids have a coach, they have a music teacher, you know, they're like, oh, there's my anthropology teacher, but they don't have a chef. And I thought these kids should have someone that they look at walking through the halls in a chef coat that they call their chef, that they feel that some of their relationship with food has to do with that person. So I wanted to be that person in the school. I kind of took a multi-pronged approach. I went through the PTO to help educate parents about easier, better, healthier lunches they might pack for their kids. So I like went to PTO meetings and did cooking demonstrations. I got in the school newsletter with suggestions of menus and, you know, a recipe or two every month. Then I went into the cafeteria, did cooking demonstrations with kids and had them try things they maybe never had before, had them make stuff with me, and then I got into the classroom. So I got into a physics class, got into a French class and did a demo and used food as a way to teach language, food as a way to teach physics, and then also went into the lunchroom and worked with the lunch lady to get, you know, Fryer Free Friday and things like that. So that was sort of my initial focus on lunch, was through the White House and Michelle Obama's program. And then I realized, like, lunch needs help, and I'm here to help. I'm going to save lunch single-handedly.
Well, what are some of the winners after this experience in the schools in particular? What are some of the successful lunches that were healthy and that kids didn't just throw away?
Well, you know, some of the easy things that parents can do, not only for themselves, but for their kids, like everyone eats hummus right now, I think. It's a pretty common, you know, dipping food that you can either go, you know, for veg for dip or go with pita. But I do a pea hummus. So instead of using chickpeas, I use green peas, which are inexpensive, easy to get. It's from frozen peas, but it's the same sort of olive oil, garlic, salt and pepper. I do a little bit of fresh mint. It stays green forever, so it's not like guacamole where it, you know, goes brown after you've snuck a fingerful of it. And it travels really well. So that's a great, you know, and you could smear it on a roast beef sandwich as well. So it can be a topping, it can be a dip. It can't be a milkshake, but almost anything else.
So you get some veggies in there. Yeah. What is your go-to lunch when you've got a hectic day, you're doing a lot of things, and you do want to nourish yourself? What is something that you cook from your cookbook that really helps you feel supported?
Well, those are two separate questions. I was like, cold fried chicken. Oh, wait, not, that's not that healthy. And then you rephrased it to something from my cookbook. So I'm going to flip through the entrees right now. I've got, you know, simple, oh, this is one of my favorites, the chicken drumsticks with chili sauce. So it's kind of like a buffalo wing, mm-hmm. but they're drumsticks. So they've got, you know, a lot of flavor to them, but it's, you know, it's kind of like a dip and roast, easy to prepare the night before. You don't even need silverware. You know, it's something that kids would eat. They can, you know, pick it up with their hands. So the chicken drumsticks with chili sauce, obvious accompaniment would be celery sticks with blue cheese vinaigrette. But I also do, there's a loaded baked potato salad in here that might go really nicely with that.
And you hit, you used a key phrase there, I think, make the night before. What gets me on my lunch as an afterthought thing is if I'm getting ready for work in the morning, I'm not going to take the time then to prepare the lunch. We have to think ahead.
Right. So much of this is about do ahead. What steps can be done ahead? And, you know, that's where my chefing is less important and the fact that I'm a mother becomes really important because I don't have time. I don't have time to even finish a recipe from start to finish. So the idea of being able to do steps ahead of time really makes the difference between my kids getting something interesting for lunch and getting something boring.
Gail, have you seen all these books out recently saying Italian kids eat best or French kids eat best and they really know how to do it and they cook homemade food in France or Italy or fill a name of country here that's better than the United States? And one of the things I think that's so hard is what you and Rob were just talking about is finding any time, let alone, you know, the night ahead. That's one thing. But how do we find time in our lives to cook all these things, let alone lunch, which is right now, I guess, sort of our grab-and-go meal? How do we make time during our lives?
I think there's sort of two answers to that question. One is, you know, a little bit of planning so that the thing you're making the night before can then morph into something else for lunch. I did an article in a Chicago magazine that talked about, like, here's a pork shoulder that you can braise all day, you know, or braise in the late afternoon for dinner, and then here's the pulled pork sandwich for the next day that comes out of that. So sort of cooking something that becomes two meals. It's dinner that night, and the leftovers morph into this. And then there's also stuff that's super simple, like one of the pastas I do. It's basically a fresh pasta. You're cutting up fresh cherry tomatoes, fresh garlic. You're tossing it with your pasta, some olive oil, some mozzarella, like fresh mozzarella cheese, and it's a room temperature pasta with some torn basil. But as the flavors sort of sit in your lunchbox for the 2 or 3 hours till you've got, you know, till you eat it, these flavors like marry and meld together and just create a beautiful balance. So there's sort of two versions of that. One is, you know, actual do ahead, and some is just simpler stuff.
I like that idea of planning a dinner, but planning to repurpose it like you did with the pork sandwich there.
That's the perfect way to call it. Repurposing is a great way. Like I do these panko crusted chicken strips. It's literally chicken breasts that I'm, you know, rolling in like egg, dipping an egg, rolling in panko crust, browning them, and then the next day they make like a killer taco for you to bring in your lunch.
It does sound good. Rob and I
both
worked up at that.
Yeah. And so this is what my kids eat. You know, and part of it was just going through schools. I used to sneak into my son's school and like, oh, he forgot his gloves, so I have to deliver them. And I was like the culinary cop that would walk up and down the lunch tables to see what parents were packing for their kids. And I always left really sad. Hmm. Like, I just felt like there was so much prepackaged stuff that parents were just tossing in a lunchbox. And I thought, that doesn't say you love them. You know, they need to know you love them. You need to make them, like, something real. So I kind of got on the crusade then, even.
One of the recipes that you sent us is a Parmesan-crusted tilapia. Mm-hmm. Could you talk us through that recipe?
Sure. Let me just, I'm going to flip to it in my book. So it's got a nice fresh salsa on top, a cucumber, tomato, and fennel relish. Fennel is one of my favorite vegetables to use, ironically, because I lost on Iron Chef and my secret ingredient was fennel. So you'd think it would be a four-letter word in our house, but I just find it brings a lot of sort of crunch and texture. It's almost like celery, but wound up a little bit because it's got that anise flavor. So for the fish, it's very similar to the chicken I was talking about, and I love using tilapia because it's a very, you know, it's a resilient fish. It's not delicate. You don't have to be careful when you flip it that it might fall apart. It stays together. It's probably one of the more meaty fish that there are, but it's cheap. You know, it can be farm-raised, so there's no issues in terms of environmentally. And basically, I mix up an egg, dip it in that, and then I've got panko crumbs that I mix with Parmesan cheese, some chopped flat-leaf parsley, salt and pepper. And I'm just basically sautéing that on two sides. And then I do this relish ahead of time of cucumber, some tomato, fennel, some scallion, and some orange sections. So it's got like sort of salt and sweet going on at the same time, like savory and sweet, almost like sweet and sour. Then there's a little bit of vinegar and olive oil, salt and pepper, and some rough chopped basil on top of it. So super colorful. You know, think about, you got the orange, the pop of the red tomato, a bunch of green. So it's a lot of fresh, it's a lot of textural stuff satisfying you.
Sounds,
it's a great dish.
Sounds better than any lunch I've had this week. Well, we're out of time. Gail, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. Love talking to you guys. Hope you enjoy lunch.
We will try.
Thank you.
Even if I didn't make it. Okay, bye.
Thanks.
That was Gail Gann, Chicago-based chef, cookbook author, television personality, and winner of the 2001 James Beard Foundation Award for Outstanding Pastry Chef. She's the author of Gail Gann's Lunch, out at the end of this month.
And we talked to her before lunch earlier this week. By the way, you can find her recipe for Parmesan tilapia on the Central Time Facebook page.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Yesterday marked the beginning of the Wisconsin Film Festival, and throughout the show today, we're featuring films that are screening at this year's festival.
Here with us now in the studio is director and UW-Madison alum Tim Sutton. He's back in Madison for the screening of his film Memphis, tonight at the Sundance Cinema at 9. It's his second feature film, his first being Pavilion.
The film tells the story of a recording artist returned to Memphis after a recent success and a struggle charting a path forward in light of his newfound fame. The film has been called digressive and daringly experimental. It incorporates elements of documentary as it portrays authentic scenes from working-class Memphis. Here's a clip.
I'd just be wondering, you know, who really is my friends, you know? Seems like every time I come around and look for one of them, it always something happened to me. You know, I'd be wondering if they're trying to set me up, get rid of me or what, but you know, it's gonna be hard. They've been knocking little chunks out of me, but I ain't gonna lay down. You know, I'm not laying down with nothing in the world until the man upstairs called me, you know? Yeah.
The film was funded with a grant from the Venice Biennale and was an official selection at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. Tim, welcome to the show and welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
Well, we heard there the protagonist of Memphis. He's dealing with success and the struggles that follow it. What do you do once you've achieved what you want? How does he grapple with that question through Memphis?
Well, the story is about an artist who no longer knows how to communicate. And for what reason, we're not sure, whether it's the success that's hurt him, whether it's fear, whether it's psychosis, whether it's drugs, or a combination of all these things. And the thing that music means more than the commercial world to him, or the spiritual world for him. So the church wants him to sing. The record producer wants him to sing. Everybody wants him to sing except him. Music is something else. It's something that is inherently a part of his struggle, his life, his exploration. And so he can't just do that on demand. The more they demand it, the less he can do it, and the more he becomes insane.
Well, the lead in the film is a singer himself in real life, Willis Earl Beale, and he has an incredible voice that you put to use in the film. I want to give our listeners a taste of that.
I know there's a time when one day she'll come running back, back. She'll come running back.
Ooh, gorgeous voice. Yeah. Did you have a vision for how you wanted to use it in this?
Well, Willis is, you know, a true outsider artist. People think because he's black and he's from Chicago that he's a blues singer. And the thing about Willis is he's a real, he's a true artist. And he is raw and completely talented on a level that you get by being born, not necessarily by being taught or developing. And so I knew I wanted this story, kind of like the city of Memphis itself, this raw, beautiful thing that some people don't understand. Willis was a real metaphor for that one as soon as I met him, and he was this character, and he fit right into the city. And so I knew I wanted him to be creating stuff on, you know, on site. We gave him a little tape recorder, a little Casio, and like Willis is not a guitar virtuoso, but he is a musical genius. And so the more time he spent around set and driving around Memphis and sitting in the spaces, the more he would create these really intoxicating, you know, lullabies in a way. And so I knew as soon as he started doing that we would use that throughout the soundtrack.
You touched on this a bit. Let's talk more about the role of the city of Memphis as a character. It's the title, obviously. I've seen people describing the film as feeling more like documentary in some ways than anything. Why Memphis? What drew you there?
Well, you know, I wanted to tell a story of an African-American singer who it, at the height of his powers, is going crazy and losing it. And I also wanted to create a kind of folktale, an American folktale. And to me, the northern tip of the Delta, you know, where Elvis sang, where Martin Luther King was killed, where all this great, rich American music was created and then almost forgotten, that was the city to me that had so much to offer. And again, like Memphis is a city of churches and it's a city of trees and it's this great spirituality. And at the same time, it's completely, it's cursed, you know? And so I wanted to bring Memphis into light from a regular point of view, an outsider's point of view, but not try and adorn it with anything, not try and do Beale Street, but go to the outskirts and let Memphis kind of, and Memphians who populate the movie, be who they are. Because I think there's a magic to that city and to the people who live there.
There's a review in Variety, I think, that says the film is challenging because it does feel maybe digressive and
yeah,
experimental.
A lot of other things, right?
A lot of other things, and people are, you know, maybe challenged about, is it a documentary? As you said, you went almost like cinema verite. It's
right.
Really happening in real time.
Right.
Why is it challenging to people here?
Well, I think we're also, as a media-going culture, are now expecting a certain genre and a certain formula. We have a certain shot put in front of us, and we expect the reverse shot to then follow up. What I'm interested in is letting things develop and letting things move at their own pace, not necessarily at the pace that movies are supposed to move at. And so when a critic says it demands a viewer's patience, well, you know, that's okay, because the person who's going to give it their patience is going to get more than a movie. They're going to get an experience that is something bigger and at the same time something that they can really take the time to daydream in.
Just briefly, do you have a next project in mind?
I have a couple next projects in mind, and both projects play with form in the same way that Pavilion and that Memphis play with form, in terms of not necessarily documentary, not necessarily fiction, but a hybrid, kind of inhabiting a hybrid space, and telling stories is secondary to me. I'm much more interested in creating cinematic worlds.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Okay. But Tim, thank you so much for joining us. Sure. Great to have you back in Wisconsin.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with director and University of Wisconsin alum Tim Sutton. His film Memphis is screening at the Wisconsin Film Festival tonight at 9 at the Sundance Cinema. Now we turn our attention to the demands of modern life, as a lot of us feel overwhelmed by the responsibilities of work and family.
Our next guest felt that way too, and she wanted to do something about it. She set out to discover what's driving our increasingly hectic lifestyles and what, if anything, we can do to be good workers and good parents and maybe carve out some time for ourselves along the way.
Joining us now is Bridget Schulte. She writes for The Washington Post and The Washington Post Magazine, and she's the author of the new book, Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. Bridget, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And as your book writes, as you say in your book, we all, almost all of us at least, feel pretty overwhelmed right now. There's a lot going on, juggling work, making time for exercise, family, and it can be exhausting. In terms of your own personal story, what was the moment when you kind of thought, this is crazy, and there's got to be a better way to live?
Well, you know, to be perfectly honest, this whole book came about completely by accident. I really never stopped in that sort of busy, crazy, overwhelmed state of mind to sort of think about, you know, why it felt so insane, really. I thought that was just the way that it had to be. I'd made this choice, I guess, to be a working mother, and everybody else around me seemed to be like this. And then a Time News researcher told me I had 30 hours of leisure a week, and I about fell out of my chair. I was like, well, where is that time? And honestly, that's what started this whole journey, is he laid down a challenge, and he said, yes, you do have these 30 hours of leisure. Come and do a time study, and I'll show you where they are. And so that's what started this whole exploration. And you're right. It's not just, I initially thought it was just women and mothers, but it's not. It's fathers. It's also, it's just everybody. Work hours are increasing for people on one end of the socioeconomic spectrum, and on the other, they're cobbling together two and three jobs just to try to make ends meet. So everybody's feeling quite breathless.
Well, let's start with your visit with the sociologist known as Father Time, I think people have called him. and you were skeptical. He said, hey, busy person, you actually have 30 hours in there of, I'll throw it in quotes, leisure time, and did this time study. What did you learn about time management? Did he convince you that you had untapped time potential there?
Well, you know, I did. I brought my journals to him, and I kept them in these little black books because they were, you know, the time template that he gave me, I had to sort of define my time. Was it work or sleep or personal care? And honestly, my time was sort of everything all at once, all the time, and it never made any sense. And so he said, just keep a journal and I'll figure it out. So I brought him these little journals, and believe me, they had coffee spilled on them and my kids' juice. So they'd been through the dryer a few times. And he took out a yellow highlighter and he highlighted 27 hours of what he called leisure time. And I looked at it and I just felt deflated, because I was thinking leisure would be these long stretches where you could think or read or lay on the beach or something. And they were sort of 10 minutes here, 15 minutes there, these little bits and scraps that I called time confetti that really didn't add up to anything.
So how do you make the time confetti add up to something?
Yeah.
I'm like you. I have, you know, random scraps of time that don't feel like I can do anything more than thumb through my email or check mail quickly. Where do you get the leisure out of the confetti?
Well, you know, what really helped me, what a gift, really, this in writing this book, it really enabled me to sort of report about modern life and take my same lens that I use as a reporter and ask very deep questions. And so I found what I call bright spots, where workplaces are changing and work hours are not crazy for everybody, where couples are really working to try to share the labor more fairly at home, and where people do value leisure time. Right now, we've got busyness as sort of a status symbol. And so I learned a lot from looking at these sort of role models or positive bright spots out there, and that there are ways to try to knit together that time. And, you know, there's several things that need to change on a big scale, but there are things that we can do on an individual scale. And the first thing, I call it flip your to-do list. I always felt so much pressure to get everything done on my to-do list. And honestly, when you take the time, you take a pause and sort of step out of the swirl and think, what's really most important to me right now. You know, the to-do list is still going to be long when I die. You know, I'll still have dishes to do. What's most important to me right now? Flip that to-do list and do the things that bring you joy first, and find, you know, until it becomes more of a habit, really schedule time for that.
Okay, but the dishes are still sitting there, and even if I'm sitting and reading a book or staring at the sunset, my mind knows that the dishes are still there and they're not getting any cleaner. How do you break that mental habit?
You're right, but that's exactly right. The social scientists have the most perfect term for that, I was to discover. They call it contaminated time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's it.
You know, that you walk around and you just feel polluted. And I love that because I mean, think about it. How many times have you gotten in your car to drive somewhere and you find you sort of wake up 15 minutes later and you wonder, where am I? Where am I going? And I don't remember anything of the last 15 minutes. We get so lost in our thoughts, in our worries, you know, kind of tracking the to-do list and, you know, thinking, did I do this at work? Did I meet this deadline? Oh, my goodness, what's for dinner tonight? That we get so lost in our thoughts that we're not fully where we are. So the way you turn that off is first notice that, you know, and then, you know, kind of one of the things that I learned to try to do is I call it a brain dump, where I get all of that out of my head. So it lives on paper somewhere. It's sort of like this master to-do list, if you will. And then I give myself permission, you know, once it's out of my brain, I don't have to think about it. It doesn't contaminate my time. And then I give myself permission to maybe never do it.
Now, you're talking about strategies that we can use to carve out pieces of time and to reclaim it. But my first thought when I was reading your book was that it's not our fault that we're busy. We're busy because we're busy. More and more of us have to work two jobs to have two incomes, maybe, in a household to survive. Technology makes us busier, and the demands at work are greater because of technology. Are we maybe just busier because life is busier and the economy is rough?
Well, those are really good points. And that's why when I talk about change in the book, it's really a call for change on some very large levels. You're right. We've got these really crazy work hours, and we've got workplaces that still value long hours and time sitting at your desk. I call it FaceTime warriors, rather than really looking at performance. And that's why I went out to look to see, are there places that are doing it differently? And truthfully, one of the most inspiring stories that I saw was from the Pentagon. In the middle of two wars, Michelle Flournoy, who was one of the top civilian officials at the Pentagon, looked at her workers and saw that they were all burned out, just like what you're saying, the demands of technology, you know, feeling like they had to work all the time. And she said, you know, these are the people I need to think clearly, and they're not able to do their best work because they're here all the time and they don't have time for their families or themselves. So they brought in a consultant. They took these pulse surveys to kind of get a sense of how people were feeling. They completely revamped the way that they worked. They allowed flexible work. They wanted to bound people's hours to make them shorter so that if you worked a certain number of hours, then you got time off. They called it an alternative work schedule, and they built it into performance evaluations and regulations so that it wouldn't just die when she left. And then if managers, they got trained, and then if they didn't get on board, they got moved. And what she found over time, and also then Secretary Gates found, their work got better. They got smarter.
But can you take that and take it to corporate culture around the United States, where there's that mindset where the person who's working 80 hours is a better worker than the person who's working 40 and then going off and seeing their family?
Well, you know, what's so funny that the sociologists that look at that, they describe our workplaces, they call them time cages, that what we value really is time, and we reward people who spend those long hours, when there's all sorts of emerging social science, human performance science, even neuroscience showing that we really don't work very effectively that way at all. And you know what's interesting is that the whole reason that we have a 40-hour work week is because Henry Ford went out on a limb back in the 1920s. Everybody in manufacturing had their workers work 12-hour shifts 6 or 7 days a week. And Henry Ford he hired a consultant who came in, studied when was the point when his workers began to get so tired that they started making expensive and stupid mistakes, and discovered it was 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. He gave everybody a weekend, raised their pay, and everybody screamed that he was going to lose money, and this was crazy, and it was terrible. And a year later, he was making lots of money, and everybody followed suit. So I think that's one of the reasons I focused on the bright spots, is that there are places out there that are doing really innovative, creative work, which, frankly, the neuroscience shows the aha moments come in the break in the action, not when you're sitting there staring at your computer screen. So if that's what we value, and we value innovation and creativity, we really do need to work in a different way. And that I wanted to shine a spotlight on places where people are doing it differently.
We're talking with Bridget Schulte, author of the new book, Overwhelmed, about why we feel so busy all the time. Maybe we are so busy all the time, and what we can do about it. And we want to hear from you, too. Do you always feel like you're under the gun in your daily life, at home, at work? What toll does it take on you? How do you manage the priorities? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking now with Bridget Schulte, the author of Overwhelmed, about the frenetic modern-day lifestyle and why we're stuck in it and what we can do about it. You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Are you able to balance the priorities in your life? How do you get it done? And what do you think would make things easier for you? 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Bridget, one thing that has come up when we talk about busyness is the question about whether we're really busy, or in a sense, are we becoming a culture where we are competitively busy? We want to be busy because it makes us look important. It makes us look like we've got stuff to do, places to go.
That is such a great question. Well, and that was one of the questions that I had. The Time News researcher who told me I had 30 hours of leisure a week, which, knocked my socks off. He felt like people are just making it up, that they're really not as busy as they feel. And so I wanted to explore that. Is that true? Do we really have more time than we think? Well, and so I was looking for people who did any kind of research on it. I didn't know. And I found somebody in, of all places, Fargo, North Dakota, who makes it her business to study busyness and the fast pace of life. And I'd called her up and I said, really? Fargo? I was thinking people felt this kind of competitive busyness, and like, I live in the Washington, D.C. area, maybe Washington or New York, L.A. or big cities. And she said, oh, honey, do you want to meet some overwhelmed North Dakotans? I can arrange that. And it was so interesting to go to a focus group and see everybody around the table did feel busy, but there was this kind of one-upsmanship going on in this focus group. And then somebody burst in, apologizing for being late, and then said, oh, and then I got stuck in traffic. And I looked out the window, and, I've been stuck in traffic, believe me, on the Beltway in Washington at rush hour, and there's like three cars at the traffic light, and I see the cornfields beyond it. And that's when that's when it really hit me that, yes, we are busy. Like you were saying earlier, we've got these, more intense workplaces, and we expect long hours, and our standards for what it takes to be a good parent have increased. But, so we are naturally more busier. We are busier, but it's also become such a cultural value that sometimes we create it, when it may not necessarily be there, because we want to show status. We want to show we're worthy and important.
How do we catch ourselves doing that? How do we stop doing that?
Awareness is the first step. You have to see that, first of all, when you were saying earlier, it's not all our fault. It's really not. It is that these larger cultural forces sort of at work on us, and the very fact that, frankly, our lives have changed, but our workplaces and our policies, and our views of who should do what in terms of, men and women, they haven't changed. They're still kind of stuck in the 1950s. So all of that creates this kind of pressure on us. So the first thing that you can do is be aware of that, be aware of those pressures, and then try to, again, pause, just even take a breath and disrupt that cycle. Think about how we even talk to each other. How are you doing? Oh, I'm fried. I'm so busy. How are you doing? Yeah, same. I haven't slept in weeks. Maybe before you have that conversation, you know, disrupt that and ask yourself, is that really how you want to be communicating? Is that really how you feel? And it may be, but, you know, maybe change the way that we talk, change the way we start thinking about these things.
Yeah, that doesn't sound anything like our daily office conversations, Veronica.
Not at all. We've started each morning and talking about how terribly we've slept this week, but that's a whole other story. I want to learn some more lessons from your life, because you seem like you've come out the other end of the tunnel of the overwhelmed lifestyle. What does your life on a day-to-day basis look like now compared to when you began this whole time awareness project?
Well, the first thing that I must say is I am still very much a work in progress. You know, I read chapter one of that book, and it's a little hard for me to read because I don't like going back to that place where I was. So, yes, things have gotten better for me. But, you know, I still have a long way to go. I guess I'm learning. Time is feeling better to me. And there's a couple things. I think it was very helpful for me to understand some of these larger forces that we're talking about, this kind of ideal worker, overwork culture that we have. And also, I was a really guilty working mother. I was very worried that I wasn't doing enough for my kids, so I was overdoing all the time, you know, up until 2 a.m. baking the cupcakes, or, you know, 4 a.m. to put together the fifth grade slideshow for the promotion ceremony, you know. And what was so interesting is finding out that mothers today, even when they work full time, the time studies are showing they're still spending as much or more time with their children than stay-at-home moms did in the 60s and 70s. And that blew my mind. But then when you look at where the time came from, we've given up on housework. We're not doing as much. So, you know, there are those dirty dishes you were talking about earlier. You know, we're not doing as many dishes or keeping our houses as clean. We're not spending as much time sleeping or taking care of ourselves. And we've given up almost all of our personal leisure to spend our time with our kids. So just knowing that I was a good mom, even though I was a working mom, really helped me ratchet it down a little bit. And then it also helped me learn what's best for kids. What do kids really need? And when their parents are stressed out and tired, you know, and our cortisol, the stress hormone levels, if they're raised, we come home and the science is finding that now it acts like a contagion. And the kids' stress hormones level rises as well. And that's not good for their health. And having, you know, cranky, tired, you know, resentful, angry mom all the time is certainly not good for them. And that what they need is not sort of me hovering and helicoptering over them. You know, they need unstructured time to kind of think and play and figure out what they like. And then what's really important when I'm with them is that I have that sense of connection, that closeness. And that could be as simple as watching them blow bubbles, you know, that it doesn't have to be some big moment, you know, that if I don't get them to every single lesson, they're going to somehow never go to college. So that helped me a lot. And then I did learn some strategies that I found very, very helpful. I mentioned one earlier, flip the to-do list, where I don't feel like I have to do all this stuff then before I can ever have a moment of peace. I take that moment of peace when I need it. I set my priorities first, and taking care of myself is now one of the priorities, because if I'm sick and unhealthy and cranky, I'm no good to anybody. I'm not good at work. I'm not a good wife. I'm not a good mother. I'm not a good friend. So I've now made that a priority, and things fall underneath that. And then, you know, when we were talking about time confetti, I try to gather or chunk my time so that when it's time to work, I'll turn off the internet, I'll turn off the phone, and I'll try to work in what Tony Schwartz of the Energy Project calls pulses, short, intense pulses of no more than 90 minutes. And then I take a break and I change the channel. And then I try to limit the time I do, say, social media or internet, because I can get lost in that and go down, you know, like a rabbit hole and come up hours later. So I'll try to set a timer and do it for, say, 30 minutes. And then come back up, and then go into another kind of intensive work period, and then come back up. And then I'll do like all of the household errand stuff that I needed to do. So I try to sort of gather my time so I don't feel so out of control all the time.
You've been researching all this about being overwhelmed, and you're a parent. Are you learning what you've learned? Are you trying to instill values in your kids to have them deal with these issues in a different way?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what I'm really trying to do with my kids is let them know that, you know, being in touch with what they think is important, you know, where their passions lie, that's really the most important thing. I was so fascinated by all this research. Here in the United States, we're such an achievement culture, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think that's awesome, American ingenuity and can-do spirit. But sometimes, particularly now, we're so afraid for the future, and we're so afraid that our kids won't have this great future if they don't have every lesson and they don't get this great college resume. And sometimes what we're doing is we're really overdoing for our kids, and they get to college and they don't know who they are or what they like because they've been so overscheduled. So that's really helped me kind of take my foot off the accelerator, so to speak, and give them a little bit more room to find out, well, what are they like? And, you know, what are passions that they can follow that are then going to feel more true to them? And what I found fascinating is there's emerging social science that shows when kids do that and you parent for happiness first, you actually promote achievement.
You know, in lots of cases, America is profiled as a culture that does have the pedal down all the way, that we're trying to zoom as fast as we can. There are other countries that have similar cultures, but there are also countries that seem to have a different take on what the work-life-leisure balance is. Did you look at any of those and lessons we could learn?
Well, I did. Again, because I was trying to look for bright spots and lessons to learn. And I was at a time use conference, an international time use conference, and I learned that women and mothers in Denmark have almost as much leisure time as fathers and men do. And that was really quite unusual. In most countries across the world, there's a leisure gap, if you will, where men have more time than women. And that the women's time always tends to be very fragmented. But in Denmark, the women had less fragmented time. They had almost as much leisure as men did. They had these unbroken stretches of it. And they had more what they call pure leisure, or time to themselves. And here in this country, we consider that sort of selfish to have me time. Oh, I could never do that. And so I went to Denmark, and it was fascinating. I learned that you can't really understand why a culture has leisure without looking at work and their home relationships. That whole work, love, and play are all very interrelated.
And we'll have to leave it there. We'll have to leave it there. Bridget, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bridget Schulte is the author of Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk about tomorrow's presidential elections in Afghanistan. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.